This episode is brought to you by Interactive Brokers. Access a vast selection of global fixed income securities at Interactive Brokers Bond Marketplace. Search their deep availability of over 1 million bonds globally and use IBKR's bond search tool to compare available yields against those of other brokers. Interactive Brokers has no markups or built-in spreads and low, fully transparent commissions on bonds. IBKR displays the highest bids and lowest offers received from the electronic venues they access. In addition, clients can interact with each other by placing bids and offers online to execute their trades. Learning why Benzinga rated Interactive Brokers their best online broker for bonds for two consecutive years. Interactive Brokers is a member of SIPC. Visit IBKR.com/bonds.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Looking at the relationship you have with money and the relationship money has with you. We're going to talk about the awesome portfolio, use of credit cards, all sorts of things with our guest. And that is Jared Dillian. All this and much more on episode number 875 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Great welcome to you. I'm so delighted to be with you again. And this week should not disappoint. I'm really looking forward to this discussion. I'm Andrew Horowitz, president of Horowitz & Company. And yes, we do investment work for you and people just like you. And we manage money. And if you're not with us right now, well, you could be. Just mosey on over to TDI, the website, thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And check it out. Drop us a line. Let us know what kind of things you have on your mind. And maybe we can help you out. And who knows, maybe you'll be with us for a very long time, like most of our clients are. Now, I've been looking forward to having this guest on this week for a while. It was first introduced to me by some listeners, then even clients mentioned, hey, you need to get this guy on. So Jared Dillian, he's the editor of the Daily Dirt Nap, a daily market newsletter for investment professionals, and has been continuously published since 2008. He graduated from the U.S. Coast Guard Academy in 96, B.S. in Mathematics and Computer Sciences, from the University of San Francisco in 2001 with a master's in business administration, concentration in finance, and the Savannah College on Art and Design in 2023 with a master's in fine art in writing. Well, that makes sense how you get to writing about finance right there. So he was a trader for the Lehman Brothers from 2001 to, yes, 2008. He's the author of plenty of books, Street Freak, Money and Madness at Lehman Brothers, All the Evil of This World, which was published in 2006. Those Bastards, 69 Essays on Life, Creativity, and Meaning, that was published in 2023. And the latest, No Worries, How to Live a Stress-Free Financial Life. So we're going to get to our guest right now and get into some of the things about money and finance and how it impacts your life and all about his ideas about creating things like the awesome portfolio. So let's get to our guest. It's Jared Dillian. Jared, thanks for joining me. Appreciate it.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So let's go back so people can get a little bit of a taste. I did give a little bit of an intro for you that you heard. So tell us a little bit about how you got to where you are today. Take us back as long as you want.
Well, you know, I used to be in the Coast Guard, went to the Coast Guard Academy for college, majored in math, and I ended up spending 9 years in the Coast Guard.
Wow.
So while I was in the fleet, I took an interest in finance and basically bought every finance book out of the local bookstore, decided to apply to business school. I went to get my MBA at the University of San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And while I was doing that, I got a job on the floor of the Pecos Options Exchange. Mm. And that was my first real job on Wall Street. And then in 2001, I got hired by Lehman Brothers.
Oh.
And
for those of you who are old enough to remember them.
Yeah. Worked at Lehman for 7 years. The first 3 years I did index arbitrage. And then after that, I was the head of ETF trading. And then when Lehman went bankrupt, I started my newsletter. I started the Daily Dirt Nap. I've been doing that for 16 years. Hmm. I have written 5 books. The fifth one is coming out in October. The first one was Street Freak, Money and Madness at Lehman Brothers, which was a memoir about my time there. I have a novel, have a collection of essays. In the new book is called No Worries, How to Live a Stress-Free Financial Life. I also got another degree. I got a master's in fine arts in creative writing from Savannah College of Art and Design. And I was a Bloomberg columnist for 5.5 years. I've written for Forbes. I've written for Malden Economics for a long time. So that's pretty much it.
So you love writing. You love the transfer of thought to paper.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Yep.
I used to do a lot of writing. I mean, I started out way back, you know, writing for myself, right? You know, notes and things. And then I said, okay, let's expand this and blogging and writing all sorts of things. And then I kind of, the medium changed for me in 2007. I wrote my first book, by the way, in 2006. Well, I was writing it in 2006. It was published in 2007, 2008, right around there. But when I was introduced to podcasting, and I said, gosh, you know, that suits my style somehow so much more. Same concept, right? Getting something from thought out there. But it's a great way, I find, either one of these, which you do also, of a process of thought, right? Of from thought to conclusion, which is always kind of a cool process.
Yeah. You know, I've written in my first 5 books, I've written in 5 different genres. I've done memoir, novel, essays, trade nonfiction, and now short stories is the fifth one. I don't think I can say with pretty much certainty that that's never been done by anybody in history. So
wow, it's pretty wild. So for those of them out there that are listening that have no idea what that means, Dirt Nap, and why you got the name for that as your newsletter, let's do both.
Yeah, so to take a dirt nap means to die. And I picked this up when I was on the options floor in San Francisco. You know, on West Coast hours, the market's open from 6:30 to 1 o'clock. And a lot of the traders were surfers. They would go surfing after work. And, you know, surfers have their own lexicon. And they would stand on the floor and they'd look up at the screens and they'd say stuff like, dude, the spoos are taking a hella dirt nap. And dirt nap was a big word on the floor. And I thought it was hilarious. And I brought it back to New York and now everybody says it. So
the final resting place of the soul in the dirt.
Yeah.
The long sleep. The long sleep. So, okay. So let's talk about some of the things that are going on these days. One of the things that you talk about and you try to do a lot of, I would call it financial education, right? Is a big thing that you do. You know, you talk about it's not a million small decisions that determine whether you have money. It's 3 big decisions. You want to expound?
So people have kind of been indoctrinated in this idea that, you know, if they don't buy coffee from Starbucks in the morning, then they will have money. Like the $4 they spend on coffee, like somehow makes a difference. And this adds up to something. And this determines whether you have money in the long run. So you can do the math on that. $4 times 225 days a year is $900. And if you did that for 40 years, that's $36,000. $36,000, right? Whereas, and that is a million small decisions. That's a million financial decisions you have to make. Or you get a house that's 500 square feet smaller. You spend $100,000 to $200,000 less on the house, and you spend $200,000 less on interest payments on that loan over 30 years. So one of the things that causes financial stress is the frequency of financial decisions that we have to make that people agonize over, right?
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's buying coffee or looking for a generic can of soup or just meaningless stuff like that, like, you can do the math. This stuff does not make an impact on your life. It's really three big things. It's buying a house, buying a car, and going to college and getting student loans. If you get those three things right, then you really do not have to worry about the small stuff.
It's interesting. So you're not a big fan of Susie Orman?
No. I mean, I'm sure we would get along if I met her. I'm sure she's a nice lady. But, you know, I mean, like, really, my book, No Worries, is the antidote to that kind of nonsense. Like, it just does not. And she's not the only one. Like, Mark Cuban said this the other day, that people should be eating mac and cheese to save money.
Let them eat cake kind of thing, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. Kevin O'Leary has made similar comments. Like, this is not what gets you into wealth, is these small decisions. And by the way, one thing I didn't really talk about in the book, you know, really the biggest decision that you could possibly make is getting a job in a company that gives you equity or options.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So if you get, just for example, if you got a job as the secretary at NVIDIA, you're a millionaire, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, stuff like that matters, not the mac and cheese.
Right. Yeah. So, there's a lot of stress, like you said, in all these incremental decisions that have to be made. You know, do I buy the 70 inch or the 80 inch? Do I, you know, TV? Do I get the coffee or not? Do I go to this gas station and wait for the next one for 20 cents less? Right. Those are the small million little bitty decisions that eat up a lot of space in the brain. But in fact, I'm just kind of summarizing what you said. Don't make the difference that you really want to have in life to create wealth.
Yeah. And
They don't hurt.
I just want to add that, you know, I don't want to be misinterpreted. I don't want people to say, well, you know, those things don't matter at all. Like, it's good to say, like, saving money is good. And like, being frugal is good. And if you can save a couple bucks here and there, but it's not worth agonizing over. And a lot of the things that people scrimp on are little teeny tiny luxuries, like the coffee. Like, the coffee is a small luxury. And what I've found is that people cannot give up small luxuries. They can't give up the coffee in the morning, but they can give up big luxuries. You can get a house that's 300, 500 square feet smaller, and you're not sitting in the house saying, oh my God, this house sucks, I hate it, I can't wait to move out of here. No, you're perfectly happy in the house. So people can give up big luxuries, but they can't give up small luxuries.
Yeah, I hear you. Now, some other source of financial stress, things that you talk about are, for example, debt and risk. Now, you know, that goes without saying that obviously too much of either can, you know, that it's over your level of comfort, that can cause a lot of stress. But really, let's bang this out. What are you really talking about here?
So the two sources of financial stress, and there are no other, are debt and risk. Those are the only two sources of financial stress. Debt is pretty obvious. If you have a lot of debt, if you're struggling to make the payments, if you're worried about missing a payment, that's going to cause you an incredible amount of stress. And risk, having a lot of risk in the financial markets, is also going to cause you a lot of stress. If you can you cannot completely eliminate debt, you cannot completely eliminate risk, but if you can minimize it, you'll have a lot less stress and you'll be happier.
Mm-hmm. Obviously. Now, there's this idea. We're going to stay on the same in the same area for a minute. Then we'll go to other areas. But this idea that, you know, can I have a healthy relationship with money? Now, obviously, different strokes for different folks, right? There's some people that I know people that, like, the stock market, I can't take the risk. I'm like, really? But meanwhile, they invest in, like, these crazy things that are, like, stupid, to be honest with you. And they've lost a ton of money with it. But the stock market, no. See, one of the risks, I mean, one of the stressors that I see with the stock market. So hear me out here and tell me what you think. You got a stock market that's live, ticking, moving, grooving, doing its thing, not 24 hours a day, but all day, 5 days a week. Now, you invest in that. You put your, I don't know, pick what, how much it is, $250, $500 million, whatever it is. You put it in there and you're seeing this thing. I put $1 million in. It's worth 990. Oh, it's worth $1.2 million. It's worth, 875. You know, this is moving around. You see it. It's transparent. It's always there. It's in front of you. It's on every TV station. It's on every radio. It's on the podcast. You have a house. It takes the same $1 million you put in your house. You don't see the daily movement of the value. So it's kind of like something you don't think about. Now, if you have the ability to do the same thing with your money in the stock market or investments, whatever you want to call it exactly, that you do with your house, which nobody's freaking out going, oh my God, did you see my house was worth $5,000 less today? Right? You know what I'm saying? That I'm watching. Maybe there are some people doing that, but you know, that's it's not healthy to have an up close and personal all the time in your face relationship with your money, is it?
Man, you brought up some really, really good points. You know, the funny thing is that housing is not really a great investment. Over the last 100 years, it's returned about 4% a year, which has barely beat inflation. It's returned more recently in the last couple of years, but over time, it's only been about 4%. But even though it's not a great investment, for a lot of people, it's the best investment. Because of exactly what you said, they're not getting that constant flow of information on price changes, right? Like you do in the stock market. And so people can buy a house and they can hold it for 10 years and they can let it compound. And then when it's time, when they get another job or it's time for them to move, they sell it and they realize those gains, but they let the gains compound. You know, in the stock market, and I actually talk about this in the book, this idea that more information is actually worse than less information. Mm-hmm. You know, we have our phones. You can pull up your stocks every 60 seconds, every 5 minutes, every 10 minutes and check them throughout the day. It's not healthy. Like, think of it this way. If you check your portfolio once a day, you have a 48% chance of getting negative feedback. There's a 48% chance that it's going to be lower. If you check your portfolio once a year, there is a 26% chance that it's going to be lower, right? Hmm. So for the people who check it constantly, they're constantly getting this negative feedback. And often what it causes them to do is to sell winning trades too early, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of people believe that like not being disciplined about losing trades is the worst thing. It's actually not. It's about not letting your winners run, right? Because you're constantly getting this feedback in the form of price changes.
Yeah, and then, you know, what happens is you're like, and most of it, we're wired to do something like this. Ugh, it's down. It'll come back. Oh, it's up. Let me take some profits. That's the wiring of the average investor. And it's there's something to be said about holding when things are down and you believe in the stock and it's going to come back up. But on the other hand, it doesn't match with the other side of holding when things are good. So that's something to.
Yeah.
The other thing you talk about is the awesome portfolio. I just like the name of that. The awesome portfolio. What is the awesome portfolio?
Well, the awesome portfolio is really the way that you can let your investments compound and grow over time without stress. So let me explain. It is made up of five things: stocks, bonds, cash, gold, and real estate, 20% each. And you rebalance it once a year. The awesome portfolio has returned 8.1% a year with half the volatility of an 80-20 portfolio. And the max drawdown in any year has been 12%, right? So you have this thing that returns 1% less than the stock market, and the worst year you can possibly have is down 12% versus down 38% for the stock market, and you have half the volatility. That is how you let your gains compound over time. The awesome portfolio doesn't cause you stress. What it is, it's a bunch of different asset classes all lumped together that are not really correlated with each other, which cancels out the volatility. And it literally doesn't grow in a straight line fashion, but pretty close as you can get. Now, you know, you have a bunch of choices. If you invest in stocks, you can get 9%. If you put money in a savings account, you can get 5%. This is something that gives you almost the return of stocks with half the volatility. And that's what makes it so valuable.
You know, if I could throw out the really double awesome portfolio idea, if I may, stick some alternative investments in there. Like a fund of funds. So you can get this stuff on a mutual fund or even some ETFs, but a fund of funds or maybe even alt arbitrage deal or maybe something to do with commodity trading. Just, I'm saying, kind of smooths that out even more. Smaller position, not a 20, but like a 5.
Yeah, there's a guy named Jason Buck at Mutiny Funds who does pretty much the exact same thing.
Yeah.
The awesome portfolio is for the average investor who doesn't, maybe is not accredited and doesn't have the ability to invest in these alternatives. But for sure, like that would improve the risk characteristics a lot, especially managed futures.
Yep, exactly. All right, so we're going to finish up on this one item. Then we're going to get into some things like the demand in PE, running on fumes, things of that nature, what's going on these days in the market. Before we do so, we're just going to quickly break away and we're going to get a quick discussion of my good friends over at Interactive Brokers. And here's the deal. At Interactive Brokers, you don't have to wait for markets to open. Did you know that? With around-the-clock trading, you can trade over 10,000 U.S. listed stocks and ETFs, U.S. equity index options, and U.S. Treasury bonds. Around-the-clock trading helps you stay ahead by allowing you to react instantly to market-moving news and capture market opportunities. This flexibility also allows you to trade on your timetable and invest during local market hours or wherever it's convenient for you, whenever and wherever. Open an Interactive Brokers account today and discover more trading opportunities around the clock. The best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. Learn more at ibkr.com/aroundtheclock. All right, back with Jared Dillian. We're talking about the proper use of credit cards now. Credit in the form of car loans, student loans. I mean, the proper use of student loans is, if I may say, the new aged use of student loans is get as much as you can because it's going to be relieved one day.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's the definition of moral hazard. The student loans are the worst kind of debt because, it's funny. I teach a class in personal finance at the college level, usually with a bunch of freshmen. And I say to them, I'm like, did you know that you cannot discharge this debt in bankruptcy? That if you declare bankruptcy, you cannot get rid of your student loans? They have no idea. They never heard of this before. Mm-hmm. Like they're not educated on it. So the student loans are the most dangerous, right? And really your goal, when you graduate from college, you should be able to pay them off in 5 years. And generally that means you should graduate from college taking out $40,000 in loans or less. You can make $60,000 or $70,000 when you graduate. You can pay off $8,000 a year. You can get it paid off in 5 years. That's the goal.
So it's not this lifetime. Well, there are some people that obviously have a lot more student debt because of graduate school or specialty, doctors, lawyers, things like that. But what you're saying is that people should bite off what they could chew, number one. Number two, fast forward, pay it as best as possible early on so you don't have this thing hanging over your head forever.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah.
And what about credit cards, car loans?
Credit cards, a credit card is a convenient way to pay for things and it's nothing else. One of the things I talk about in the book is this idea of you want to be a bad customer of the bank. You never want to be a good customer of the bank. A good customer of the bank is somebody I know who had at one time $500,000 in credit card debt. Mm. He was paying $100,000 in interest every year and never missed a payment. He's the ideal customer of the bank.
I want to loan him money.
He was getting bled dry.
Yeah.
Really, you want to be a bad customer of the bank. Either you want to pay your bills every month, zero out the balance, or you want to declare bankruptcy and screw the creditor. But the idea of being a good customer of the bank is the worst thing in the world.
And that doesn't mean you're not making money for the bank, because when you do charge something or put your credit card down, they're getting a spiff on it.
Yeah, I mean, just from the transaction fees, they make a little bit, but you know, in my life, I have never carried a balance.
And really?
I've never carried a balance.
I remember there was one card I had a balance on way, 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 way back. I mean, I was like 20, and it was only for about a year or so. But I started to realize, like, that's just dumb, you know? And then if you look at some of these cards, you're like, okay, your payoff, if you pay the minimum of this card, you'll be paid off in 42 years. It's like, really? That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And you know, I tell people, look, this is a 20% card that you're holding. How about if I gave you a 20% guaranteed investment? Would you give me money right now? Of course I would, right?
That's a great way to frame it. Yeah. Yeah, because
pay it off, man.
If you're paying down a loan at 20% interest, it's basically a 20% return when you pay it off.
Yep. All right, let's talk about the demand in PE. You have a piece you wrote, Running on Fumes. It said, growing overdependence from endowments and pension funds is cause for major concern. Some endowments have about 30% of their portfolios in PE, private equity. Failing to meet performance expectations, such as a 20% drawdown, could jeopardize the financial stability of the endowment. You know, you talk about this, and it's really kind of fascinating because we're starting to hear a lot about private equity. As a matter of fact, recently on a CNBC survey of where people are going to put their investable assets, they did a break. I think it was like, you know, under 40 years old and over 40 years old. What was really surprising to me was the question was something like, where do you need to put money to meet your expectations with the highest degree of opportunity? Over 40, private equity is like, I don't know, 2% or something like that, something ridiculous, right? Under 40, it was like 20% of the people said yes, 25% maybe, private equity is the place. So it's kind of interesting because I think there's a lot that we don't know about private equity. There's a lot of benefits to private equity, but there's a lot of drawbacks too, isn't there?
Oh, this is a big issue. So look, private equity made sense 10 years ago when interest rates were at zero and you could buy companies at 4 or 5 times. And now interest rates are 5% and you're buying companies at 10 or 12 times. Like, it doesn't make any sense. And what you've seen with private equity, and people have experienced this in real life. Let me give you an example. I went out to PF Chang's by myself like 2 weeks ago. My wife was in Europe and I just took myself out to dinner. So PF Chang's is private equity owned. It used to be a public company and it was taken private, and it's run by a 33-year-old guy. Mm-hmm. Well, the tab for one person with no alcohol was $60.
Really?
Yeah. And I was like, that's including the tip. And I was like, this is outrageous. Like, I'll pay $60 for a dinner, but not PF Chang's, you know? So private equity basically has a formula. They come in, they buy a company, they fire a bunch of people, they raise prices, the quality of the service goes down. There's really two purposes to a business. One is to maximize profit, and two is to maximize customer satisfaction. And private equity does one without the other. It maximizes profit, but it doesn't really care about customer satisfaction because they have a different time horizon than the founder. The founder has a time horizon of infinity. They want the business to be around forever. Private equity just wants to sell it in 5 to 7 years. They have a different time horizon. So once they get their money out of it, they don't care. So, you know, they've gone into veterinary offices and dental practices and car washes and pizza places. And you're seeing this across the country. You're seeing prices go up with a significant deterioration in quality. And it's just getting worse and worse.
Now, as an investor, why shouldn't I be happy about that? Investor only.
Well, what I'm concerned about is, you know, there's significant benefits to being a public company. And the biggest one is liquidity. And I'm worried about this concentration of risk and the lack of liquidity. Now, what you've seen recently is private equity doing these dividend recaps where they're borrowing against their portfolios to pay investors cash, to pay cash dividends. So they're leveraging up even further. So really what you're seeing is an increase of leverage in the system, kind of like you saw in 2005 and 2006 with no discernible benefit. And that's what I'm really worried about is I think it poses a systemic risk.
Let me ask you a question. Let me ask you for I'm going to play Jeopardy with you, okay? So I'm going to give you the answer, and you're going to tell me what it is. Using funds and borrowing and new assets into a fund to pay current and former investors money.
What is a Ponzi?
Okay. Now, isn't that what you just said? About
yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Right? So they're basically, like I say this a lot, you know, they're eating their own arm to gain nutrition. And that becomes a problem. I also find, you know, that the way they could do things and hide things in private equity is not only the benefit of public companies, is not only equity, it's also transparency. Private equity is very little transparency. So, but you think there's going to be a day of reckoning is what I'm feeling.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. Mm. Yeah.
Interesting. Zyn. So what I know about Zyn, Z-Y-N, by the way, this is the little pouches. My understanding is it's a alt for, you know, smoking and vaping. But you're saying it's the appetite suppressant? What is that?
Actually, it's a mild appetite suppressant. Yeah, like, you know, I'm a Canada user of Zyn, and what I found is that if I'm starting to get hungry and I want a snack, if I put in a Zyn, like the need to go eat a snack like goes away.
You can do that with gum, by the way.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it works better with Zyn.
And that's tobacco in it, right?
It doesn't. That's the thing. It doesn't have tobacco. It has nicotine.
Oh, well,
so okay, the way it's manufactured is they suck the nicotine out of the tobacco and they mix it with a salt and put it in a pouch. And it's really just pure nicotine salt powder. So it doesn't have the cancer risk of tobacco. There's no carcinogens in it. So aside from, you know, nicotine does have some harmful effects. You know, you can have high blood pressure and stuff like that. But aside from that, it's basically harmless. There's no cancer risk whatsoever.
So why are we even talking about this? Because Philip Morris?
Well, I'm not sure. Well, Philip Morris. So here's what happened. So the maker of Zyn was a company called Swedish Match, which is Swedish.
Which, by the way, did make matches.
Yes. And they typically make snus in Sweden. That's what they do in Sweden. So they came out with Zyn, and I owned Swedish Match stock for a while. I made some money off of it. And then Philip Morris acquired them. I mean, just absolutely stole the company, got it at an absurdly cheap price. And they've been ramping up production, and it is a product category that is growing at 100% a year, and it is not stopping. So
is this going to hopefully be the alternative to vaping? Because I got to tell you something, the vaping thing is getting really out of control.
Yeah, it is the alternative to vaping. Like vaping can be pretty harmful. Like I know a couple people who vape, and I'm like, I just tell them like, just do the Zyn, you know, it's much better.
Mm. So let's talk about, wander into the area of crypto, shall we? Big news over the last couple of weeks is any day now, Ethereum, or ETH, if you want to call it that, is going to be packaged in ETF format. You know, there's this opportunity by a lot of different players saying it's imminent. Now, meanwhile, Ethereum got smoked with the last round of, you know, selling over the last few weeks. Is this something that's going to be good? I mean, I looked at the original ETF for Bitcoin as possibly negative for companies like a Coinbase, right? It turned out to be the price of Coinbase is more tied to the value of Bitcoin than it is the concern about them making money from selling Bitcoin. Plus, they also have the custodianship of that. Is this a big deal? Is this something exciting? We're excited about this?
I'm not really involved in crypto right now. I don't really have a horse in this race. I think securitizing crypto is a good thing. It makes me more likely to trade it. Like, you know, for example, it makes your taxes a lot easier. Yep. It's very hard to figure out your tax liability if you're trading crypto and Coinbase or some other exchange. That's a big pain in the neck. So it makes your taxes easier. It's cheaper. the transaction fees on something like an E-Trade or Robinhood are zero, but on Coinbase, they're very high. So it cuts down on your transaction fees. You know, the expense ratios on these ETFs are very low. They're about 15 or 20 basis points. Like, it's a much cheaper and better way to invest in crypto. And when I say the word invest, I mean invest. Like, if you want to trade crypto, then, you know, use Coinbase or whatever. But if you want to invest in crypto, then I think the ETFs are a better way to do it.
So,
and you can put it in an IRA.
Where is your play differential between crypto and let's say gold? Like, are you more of a gold lover, liker?
I'm much more of a gold person. Yes.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. We just actually sold our gold position a couple months ago, and gold and silver that we held for about 2 years, did well with it, and then actually rotated that into a commodity based fund that had more of a energy component to it than just precious metals. So it had precious metals and industrial metals. It has foodstuffs, you know, from anything from, you know, I don't know, cows to candy maybe or something, cocoa. And then also the area of gold is covered, but energy was a much bigger thing. But you also have a discussion of energy, something that is an area that is of interest that you're concerned about with the evolution and revolution of AI and data centers and the potential use of energy in that arena.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty simple thesis. You know, we're building data centers like crazy. They're going to suck a lot of energy. We don't have a lot of nuclear capacity in this country. It's primarily going to come from natural gas, right? So this isn't really a new idea. You know, a lot of people have thought about this idea that, you know, natural gas prices could go a lot higher and natural gas producers could do extraordinarily well. So I've investigated this a little bit. I haven't invested in it, but it could be a big idea.
But what about the utility companies? What about Next Era Energy, Southern Energy? There's a few EMC. There's a few of these guys that actually are going to be direct beneficiaries of the usage of AI. And some of them, like, you know, Next Era and a few have even mini nukes that they're not bombs, but, you know, energy related that they're working on also, because the amount of energy that this is going to be, that's going to be utilized for this seems to be at a level that's going to be so intense. I mean, there's a facility in, is it Virginia? Is it, I think it's Virginia. Intel. Somebody's building a facility that has the equivalent use of 330,000 homes per year use of energy on an annual basis. That's a lot of energy.
Yeah, yeah. And you've seen the utility stocks go up on this idea. That's been happening.
I think it's an interesting play. Plus, utilities are usually pretty good in an environment that you have lower interest rates. And then on top of it, you have a situation with regard to utilities where if there is a safety trade, if you will, you know, if that does come, if the markets ever go down, you know, utilities actually hold up pretty well.
Yeah, for sure. 100%.
Something to think about. Let's talk a little bit about politics for a second and reference. I've gotten a lot of questions recently about, you know, what if? You know, what if Trump? What if Biden? And I keep telling people that from where I sit, non-politically, if we can just strip that out for just a moment, it looks like they both are spenders. They both like to stimulate different ways. You know, Biden likes to hand out money, where Trump likes to do it through tax cuts and things like that. But what's your thoughts on maybe the financial situation, and take a couple of minutes on both Biden and Trump, what that looks like going forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think the number one Trump trade out there is the yield curve. I think if Trump gets elected, the yield curve steepens dramatically. So, you know, Trump has a track record of trying to influence the Fed to cut rates. He's made some comments, which leads me to believe that one of the first things he would do is replace Jay Powell. So you'd have somebody like Kevin Hassett in charge of the Fed.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, I think that would happen. And I think you would have, you'd probably have 200 basis points of rate cuts in 2025. So that would steepen the back end of the curve as inflation gets priced in. Even Stan Druckenmiller said if Trump gets elected, he thinks inflation is going to be 6% in 2025. So the yield curve could go from inverted to positive 200 plus in the span of less than a year.
And the majority but the majority coming off the front end of the curve.
Yeah, for sure. And that I think is the real trade. That's the real trade.
And how do you trade that?
Well, I mean, it's kind of tough to do that as a retail investor. There used to be one or two. Actually, there is a curve steepening ETF. It's called iVol, but it's not strictly a curve steepening ETF. It is, but it also invests in TIPS. So it's kind of a hybrid. But basically that ETF buys options on the yield curve. So if the yield curve did steepen 200 basis points, that would go up quite a bit. So that's one way to play it. Or, you know, if you're a big boy, you know, you can trade the cash bonds or futures or something like that.
Well, you could also actually go out. Here's an idea. What do you think? Relatively simple. If you want to play the full trade, right? There's ways to say, okay, well, let's just buy the short end of the curve in an ETF that has short-term bonds, short-term treasuries, right? That's one way because obviously interest rates will go down, price will go up. And at the same time, if you want to play the full trade, short TLT, which is the 20-year plus treasury. So you get a little bit of a bump on the rates going up on the long end, and you get rates going down on the short end. You get both sides. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that would work.
Yeah, it's complicated. And it's not like you could do either. By the way, you could do either or both. So it depends. If you think it's going to be more of a steepener with both sides, the barbell, if you will, going up in terms of rates on the long term, because there's an expectation that if we'd reduce rates, we're going to have inflation long term. Druckenmiller and a few others. I had a guest on that said we're about to hit hyperinflation, which, gosh, I don't want that. I don't even want the inflation we have now at 3%. You know, but you could do either or both, depending on where you think. What else is? You look under your mattress. What boogeymans are you finding or seeing or thinking that could be there when it comes to financial markets over the next 6 months?
Well, I think we're looking at a significant slowdown. Like all the data in the last 3 weeks, with the exception of the payroll numbers, have been pretty soft. So especially, I mean, you're seeing some of the anecdotal or like non-BLS labor market data is getting solved, and the BLS data hasn't really caught up yet. I mean, I think we're entering a slowdown. And I think the stock market is priced to perfection. I think the charts are way overextended. You know, like we have not had a 2% drawdown in the market, a 2% intraday drawdown in the market in the last 337 days. Like, I don't know. I mean, that's what keeps me up at night.
You know, it's interesting because when you look at the price of perfection and you look at some of the things that you're talking about with regard to complacency to a degree, you know, hope for more cuts by the Fed. I think you're right about the fact that anything goes wrong. Well, first of all, I think people are overlooking any short-term issues. I really think that's embedded in the psyche of the current investor. It doesn't matter. If we didn't die from COVID and the world was shut down, if we have wars that nobody really cares about too much, okay. If we have financial crisis that the Fed will come to the rescue, what am I worrying about? In fact, I want to embrace it. I'm hoping for another pandemic, right? I mean, seriously, you know, from a financial standpoint. It seems that, you know, we may have this inflationary environment that comes up, maybe, but it seems like over the last 20 years, every one of the things that were just this horror show have been dissipated by just simply throwing money at it. And it seems like there's no end in sight.
Yeah.
How much debt is too much? I mean, look, if we started this discussion about with credit cards, and we started the discussion with debt. The fact is, if you ran your household like the government runs their financial household, you would be in bankruptcy court right now. Right? You would be a debtor in collection is what you would be. So crazy stuff going on. So tell us anything in, you want to add to any of these discussions at all before we close out?
No, I think we're good.
All right. Tell us where we can get my listeners. We're going to have some things, by the way, on the show notes for episode number 875 over on the disciplinedinvestor.com. We're going to have links and all that. But tell us where we can get access to the newsletter, the books, things like that.
Yeah, the newsletter, the Daily Dirt Nap is at dailydirtnap.com. You can't subscribe on the site. You have to send me an email. And I'll give it, if you mention the podcast, I will give you a significant discount.
There you go.
Also, you can go to my author website, which is jareddillion.com. You can see all my books there. If you want to buy any of my books, they're all on Amazon. And my personal finance website is jareddillionmoney.com. And there's a lot of good stuff there.
Cool. Well, glad to finally have you on and officially spend some time together. I hope we could do it again soon.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks, Jared. And that's going to wrap it up for another edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. It's the end of the quarter. It's the end of the month. It's a time where the summer is in full swing here. So let's get it going. A lot of things are happening. Of course, we saw over the last few days, the change in the dynamic with the political environment and a lot of things that are very interesting and maybe changing as we get through the next couple of 3 months. So let's pay attention. Let's stay attuned. Let's stay very focused on what's happening. And of course, thanks for joining me again this week and every week. We have some great guests coming up. Dr. Smith's going to be on. Das is going to be on. We got Anthony Scaramucci coming back. All sorts of names over the next couple of months. So make sure to stay tuned. Oh, by the way, big announcement. You can now start listening to the podcast, the Disciplined Investor Podcast, over on YouTube. Check out the Twitter feed at Andrew Horowitz. We put it up there recently, but we transitioned and migrated from Google Podcasts to YouTube. So that's something to check out. Look up the Disciplined Investor on YouTube and make sure you subscribe to that as well. Thanks for joining me. I'll see you again soon. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.